thanks for checking us out today. So, you probably know, it seems every week, I equivocate a bit on this whole politics thing, whether to avoid it, dance around it, whatever. Politics are, like the promos for this show say, everywhere. So this week, I've decided, if you can't fight them, join them. Republicans and Democrats. There, I said it. As in, elephants and donkeys. So that's what's on tap for today. Elephants and donkeys. As in, elephants projected onto barns and bridges and talking donkeys from the Bible. For once, politics is going to be fun. Colleen Plum will discuss her work recording elephants from more than 60 zoos, then projecting those images on the most unlikely places. And Dr. Catherine Smithies joins us all the way from Melbourne, Australia, to see how the medieval ass, and that's what they called them back then, came to embody what must be the most paradoxical of all the Earth's creatures, at least from a personality perspective. I can't comment on platypuses. And as if all that wasn't enough, Dr. Tom Picard of All Pets House Calls is going to start a series this week dealing with the most common illnesses each of our pets confront and what to look for and do about them. This week it's cats, next week it's dogs, and the week after, well, you just have to wait and see. Anyway, normally at this time I tell you that it's time for animals in the news, but alas, this week there's just too much to get to, so I'm afraid you're just going to have to wait next week when Dina Blumenthal is going to be back to catch us all up. So in the meantime, let's get started with my conversation with Colleen Plum, and here it is. Colleen Plum is an American photographer, video artist, and public video projection artist. Her work investigates contradictory relationships people have with animals. Her recent projects explore the way animals in captivity function as symbols of persistent colonial thinking, that a striving for human domination over nature has been normalized, and that consumption masks as curiosity. Her work sheds light on abnormal behaviors of captive animals in order to bring attention to implicit values of society as a whole, particularly those that perpetuate power imbalance and tyranny of artifice. She recently published 30 Times a Minute, which is a collection of photographs. Well, I think I'm going to let her tell us more about 30 Times a Minute. Colleen, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. So let me ask, so this is the journey you as a photographer. Typically we think of people as they come to speed with photography. We go from still photography, right? They learn right. The craft of taking pictures, but you've taken that to the next level where you're doing actual, you know, motion image and projection image. Can you tell us a little bit about that background and sort of how you came to go from still photography to projection photography, and particularly where the animals fit into the whole background there?
Well, sure. It has been a journey. And the way that I work has been dictated, to solve the problem at hand. So my first book is called Animals Are Outside Today. They're all still photographs. And that book is about it's sort of a survey of the ways that animals are woven into human lives. Mm-hmm. And that I came at it kind of in an innocent way, I guess, without really realizing that the thesis of it would be how animals are used and exploited by humans through all of time. Mm-hmm. Is what I learned in doing that 10-year project. So toward the end, I went to the United Center and here in Chicago and saw the circus. And I wanted to include that aspect of how animals are exploited. And that's where I saw the elephants walking through the freezing cold Chicago parking lot, desolate, trunk to tail, and in this tent that had heaters. And that started my interest in looking at elephants. And so I started to investigate, I guess, with my camera. And then I discovered that they, in zoos, they exhibit what is called stereotypic behavior, where they go mad. I mean, they are so bored. They would be walking 30 to 50 miles. They live in groups. All of the things that we know about what is essential to the life of an elephant is robbed in captivity. Mm-hmm. So when I discovered this behavior where they would just rock, ceaselessly I needed to do video to capture that motion. Mm-hmm. So then I discovered it and I researched it, and then I went around to, as many zoos as I could get to. It was a lot. I went to about 60 zoos in the US and Europe to film, to collect this footage, and to almost, because it was so upsetting to see and to discover that this is going on. I couldn't believe it. And I would be at zoos and they're rocking and or pacing or head bobbing. And it seemed to not bother anyone. Or the kids would say, why is it doing that? And the parents would explain it away or rationalize, oh, they're just dancing, or some big lie. So it really was upsetting to discover that. And that's why I made all of that footage, like to collect evidence.
It's such a fascinating aspect, because I've only had experience once. It was at the Buffalo Zoo. Don't mind naming names. And it was actually part of my anthropology program. They took us to the zoo, and there was a lone elephant there, and there was no question this poor creature was miserable. It was the same symptoms that you're describing, the rocking and the trunk sort of going back and forth and the tail sort of going, just absolutely standing stationary. And there's no question, you can see it without, you don't have to be an elephant expert. The animal's lost its mind, and it's living in a living hell. That's not being dramatic. I don't think that's being dramatic. Clearly, I don't think you had that same impact. That it's gut wrenching. It's like a kick. Like this thing is really miserable.
Yeah.
And
what it represents is exactly. That this is what we are blind to, and what injustices do we just brush away and not really even acknowledge. Mm-hmm. What other all of these animals that are far roaming animals are just held because it's nostalgic. It's an old idea that needs to go into history. Yeah. That the human impulse to connect with animals and to get close to them and to see them is sort of innate. And we love to see, we're animals. Mm-hmm. So, we want to see, but there's this sort of darkness that has gone awry where we want to conquer human impulse that is from history. The earliest menageries were about flaunting wealth and showing power, and look, we can have a lion in a cage, and we have a gun to be more powerful than that lion, when in fact we would be killed. It's just this abuse of power that is
I always say that it's an abuse because we can. We're able to do it, and so we do. And so, our role as humans is to not control that. Is to really make the better. We have a choice, right? We can take the gun to the lion in the cage, or we can do the exact opposite. We can help the lion. Power is completely ours. And there's a great metaphor. It's almost the great power comes great responsibility. But it's the choice is ours for making, and no better example than I think on large animals, with elephants or tigers or primates, same type of thing. Yeah. So tell me about the listeners may not know. So the project itself, the 30 times a minute, it's now a book, but it was a long time coming. It's a project where you, like you started to say, you went to the zoos, you grab all this footage.
Right.
Then you started projecting it across cities around the world. Tell us about that.
Yes. Well, I had one show in Miami. I had this video that I compiled all of that footage into a 12-minute video that I exhibited in Miami for the first time. And I could see the reaction to it. I mean, I was nervous.
Just for people that don't know, when you say projecting, you're not going into a theater. You're projecting like on sides of buildings, on bridges, right? So. Yes. Okay.
The very first one was actually in a gallery inside.
It was a
screening. It was on a loop, and you would go inside and you would sit and watch this in this immersive space. And that was the very first time. And that's the one at the screening room. And that gave me confidence that people would watch it and were drawn to it. Because, when you see that rocking in that behavior, there's some sort of identification. People understand it because I think we can see that they're soothing themselves. They're seeking some sort of comfort in that rocking. Mm-hmm. And so that after that show, I started doing them outside. I was in Chicago and I got a grant to do a project, and they were wanting art to go out into the neighborhoods. And so I was going to do it inside at this cultural center or a community center where they had basketball. It's like a gymnasium and cooking classes and a senior center, this really vibrant area with a parking lot and drug dealing outside, you know,
perfect.
Very wide range of activity was going on. And so I thought, what if I do it outside? And so that was the first one. And I did it outside on the wall over the parking lot. And people were magnetized, like, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? And it gave me a chance to talk to people who were passing by and sort of ask them, what do they think? And what is their experience? And so it becomes a one person at a time chance to have a conversation about the status quo, about what they think. And then I got addicted. I did went around and did like 100 in different cities all over the world.
And a huge panorama. They're saying like bridges and buildings and all. I'm curious, when you mingle with the audience, when you mingle with the crowd, or you're lurking, you know, in a way, and you're talking, do they know you're the creator? Do they know that you're producer? Or you just kind of say, hey, what do you think of this? That you sort of
sometimes, you know, sometimes I, if it's a lot of like mostly it's people don't, okay, the first one was planned. So people, you know, it was announced, it was, people would come to see it. And in that case, I could just sort of lurk and watch and listen. Mm-hmm. And, but most of the time there's just people like smaller groups passing or, you know, so if I'm the one standing there with my projector, it's a big projector and I put it like on the roof of my car or somewhere that is suitable, you know, on a roof sometimes, and I'll be down on the ground, wherever I can figure out to have a good direction. It's a lot of scouting. It's a lot of like, where will this work and how many people are going to pass by tonight? Mm-hmm. So I put this like almost a radar. When I get to a city, I look, where is a cool spot? Where will enough people pass by? Sometimes not that many people come by, but they ask me, you know, I do try to engage.
Are they announced ahead of time, or are they just spontaneous?
They're all guerrilla. Well, it depends. Most of them are just guerrilla where I just show up and do it. And
cool.
It's a completely, sort of an intervention into the public space that no one understands what, you know, people will ask me like, who's sent you?
is there any legal issue? I mean, you're projecting on a public building. Is there anything, have you ever gotten in trouble for doing that?
Yeah, I've gotten, you know, kicked out, asked to leave places, but mostly it's, you know, ask forgiveness and before, you know, not permission.
Right.
And it's not late at night. Sometimes sometimes I will ask because I know that it won't, that they'll see me and that I, you know, I want it to be like the Museum of Jurassic Technology in LA. That's a private place, you know, and I wanted to engage with that location. And so I went in and I said, hey, I'm in town. Can I do a projection on the facade of your museum? And that was a great one because it's right in front of a bus stop. So people were waiting
audience.
For the bus. Yeah, and yeah. So, you know, some people have no idea what the Museum of Jurassic Technology is, but they were waiting for the bus, and, you know, I could talk with them until the bus came. Actually, that was so funny. The bus driver, he opened the door and leans out. He's like, what are you doing? And I'm like, raising awareness about elephants in captivity. And he's like, I love you.
Rest is history. You married him. No.
Yeah. I mean, then the door shuts and he drives off. It just is every night that I would do it, it was something crazy or interesting or mind blowing would happen where I would hear some brilliant thing from somebody that, you know, just is really moving. There's a lot of tears for me or, you know, goosebumps where I'm very moved by how people respond. And over here in Chicago, there was a guy who came along and we had this, sometimes they're long conversations and then strangers will talk with each other. So, and I can just step back and I just love that. But this guy said, and I have it, I was filming it, recording it actually. And he said, you know, we talked about elephants and captivity and isolation and what the captivity does. And then, somehow it came around where he said, everyone should make a new friend every day.
Nice sentiment.
Like, that's okay. Really.
That's nice. So here's a question that I have, and this is for people who listen to the show. You're probably tired of me asking this question, but it is a real point of interest for me, and that is the ability of imagery and photography, pictures, to actually have an impact. And I ask that within the organizations have to grapple with this, that showing an image that is so graphic or so violent, you have what people have called like the backlash effect. They will turn away. They can't. It's too repulsive. They turn away, and you of being counterproductive. No one looks. Yeah, and what they have to balance that against is, well, there's an obligation. This is the reality of what's going on. You know, for the cases of organizations that go into factory farms and they see, you know, the true misery, what really happens in a gestation crate, or you know, how chickens are really beaten. This is this truth. If I don't show this, I'm not being, I'm not doing my job. So it's up to you, viewer, to decide what to do with this. If you turn away, you turn away. You are in this really intriguing middle area where you're showing not a still image or not even a blood and guts gore image. You're showing a behavior that is mental. And I'm just wondering, you know, you show the elephant, the stereotypy, I think is the way we would accent that. And so when you talk to the people in the crowd, what type of reaction are you getting? And do you have a sense that they're actually moving to some kind of action?
Well, I think that a lot of it, I really understand what you're talking about, is that it's hard to share what the reality is without it being tragic. You know, it's so tragic to see. But I think that, you know, the elephants and their gigantic, you know, it's become graceful motion of soothing. And so that is a way to engage with the audience and is a gateway, and that it's a lot about context. So if I'm taking these elephants out of context and having people actually look at them in a different way on the street in a surprising way, and it is sad. I mean, it's tragic to watch the whole thing. A lot of people, it kind of is a barometer. Like, some people really are so upset to watch it because they see this deep suffering. But for other people, it shows them the reality. It makes what is real, which is what the reality of what's happening in zoos, more real and more understandable. So I think that context has a lot to do with it. And, you know, if people can actually see that and are moved, the conversation is what, you know, I don't know how much change, you know, how much as an activist, as an artist, how much can actually happen. Yeah. And that's why I started, you know, each event would happen and it was almost like water slipping through my hands. Like, I could ask people, you know, they could do little things to ask your, if you have a kid, ask the teacher to not go to the zoo, to think of an alternative and tell the zoo why. Write letters to zoos to say, stop your breeding programs. We don't want to support. We see that this is not activity any longer. So your farm, start with the far roaming animals and stop breeding them. Send them to sanctuary. You know, we have power as citizens to say to these, you know, giant organizations that are taking our money, you know, we can tell them what we want. And so I can, you know, plant those seeds. But I think that the context is a really huge part of it. And then what I discovered is I started taking still photographs of each installation to create some sort of document that would catalog all of these. You know, every time I turn on the projector, those elephants are out, visible. We can bear witness to them. And there's something transformative in seeing them in motion. Mm-hmm. And that by photographing them, I was compiling this evidence again. It was like layer upon layer of evidence doing. And then I thought, what if I can make a book of this work? And then all of these people that I've researched and I've now met at conference, them, you know, can they add their voice to this book? That has been such an important part of it, is the collaborative part of having these 9 essays included in this book, because now the book exists. Now the book, like, it's not going away. It has all of their voices, all of these messages about from Catherine Doyle, Stephen Wise, and his essay about Happy in the Bronx Zoo, mm-hmm. from the Non-Human Rights Project. It has Les O'Brien. He's a former zookeeper who is like a whistleblower, and he was ostracized so terribly for trying to change the industry from the inside. Mm-hmm. And then we have Julia Cook, who's a writer, and she came along with me on a few projections and wrote about the reaction.
I'm curious. I wanted to follow up on something you mentioned. I'm going to get to zoos here, because that's where, you know, for what we're talking about is kind of where the action is. Sort of to the traditional argument. Now, there's lots of traditional arguments for continuing this to have zoos have large animals in captivity. Is for the average Joe, it's going to be the only experience they will ever have to encounter one of these animals. They're not going to be able to go to travel to, you know, Africa or India or see an elephant in its natural environment. Going down to the zoo for a Saturday afternoon is the best that they can do. And particularly, I'm thinking children, because you mentioned when a child comes across the zoo and sees the stereotypic behavior, the elephant rocking, the child doesn't know what the deal is, right? So he's going to depend on the adult saying, oh, it's okay, this is a normal thing, it's math or whatever garbage they have. They're telling the kid, but the kid is still going to have some of a response to seeing this enormous animal and personal. And I'm just wondering if you could talk about that. And the new thing that I'm throwing a lot in one question here, there's a new movement, and a lot of zoos are doing holograms. Mm-hmm. Where they have the holographic image of the elephant. I have not seen one yet other than on video, but it seems to be incredibly successful. It seems to have an impact. So I'm just wondering if you could sort of comment on all that.
Well, that holographic idea is a great idea. And I think that, boy, there was a lot. I think that, first of all, where did we get the idea that we have the right to see them, that it's some sort of a thing that we, you know, unless you are very wealthy and can go to on a safari, that the people who can't afford that, they're relegated to the crazy ones in the zoo. Like, why is that even a good idea? Mm-hmm. That we shouldn't even be able to see them because the illness seeing them. We're not out, like, give way. And if we educate kids and say, hey, our ticket money that we paid to get in here is actually supporting, they've discovered that they don't do well in captivity. Yep. So our ticket money is helping their habitat protection or bee fences or human animal conflict areas, like actual conservation. And we could really teach kids what needs to be done. And that by seeing them, we're almost robbing of the funding that they are getting from our presence. And I also think that kids don't really, I mean, look at how, okay, no one has seen a dinosaur, right? Mm-hmm. But, and kids know every single thing about them and they love them and they, you know, there's other ways to learn and love these animals other than, and if we plant the seed that by seeing them, it hurts them, kids won't want to do it. Mm-hmm. It's just to evolve past this old idea. I mean, sure, it's really cool to see a giant elephant. It's cool to see a tiger. You can't dispute that. But to me, if we teach young people, if we teach others that it's, and so, and I was at the Detroit Zoo and I saw in the polar bear exhibit, there was no polar bear to be seen. It was a giant tank, or, well, a small tank, but a lot of land. Mm-hmm. And you couldn't see any polar bear at all, but there was a heat camera and there was a dress up, you know, like explorer outfits and stuff. And kids love that. So can we keep of what zoos can do, which is education and real conservation and promoting what can a true sanctuary be. And that kids, they like these sprinkler parks and jumping. Yes. Yeah. Thing. They like that. It's very boring. And I also think that everybody, when I talk to them, I don't know how zoos continue because everybody says, oh, I hate zoos. It's like we know on a deep level that it's not fair.
It's almost a strange throwback because I don't think if you ask the kids, if you say, you know, like what you just said. But I think there's something, there's a sense of nostalgia from the parents. When I was a kid, you know, yeah. my parents took me, you know, your grandparents took me to the zoo, and you're going to go to the zoo, you know, and there's something, maybe it just has to, like you say, we just have to evolve past this notion that there are other ways to either have experience or accept that they're not ours, you know, just because they're intriguing. We don't have any inherent right to do that, you know, unless we have a natural encounter in their natural environment. People are seeing, maybe getting the message, you know, this is a kind of a thing that we're growing past it, you know, we're growing past it. And it sounds to me like the images and the efforts of the stuff that you do is helping the cause. I mean,
I hope so. And I know that there so much work has been done by people before me protesting at circuses. And I guess that we each can play a part. I mean, we each can say what we think is right. And I mean, it's a really complicated problem in Africa, and there are experts there who, what it comes down to is no farms, no, you know, how to stop ruining habitat. You know, those are things that I'm by any stretch, informed enough to talk about. I just know that there's good work being done to solve human animal conflict. We have to stop doing what we know, what is known. Like, it is so clear that captive elephants in the United States or in European, in any zoo, they do not thrive. They do not breed. They are not being rewilded. We are not. It is only for human entertainment or this greedy idea to see them, and this false notion that by seeing them, we care more. It is not true. It is perpetuating human domination. And any problems, you know, are how to protect their habitat and how to protect those in the wild and how to stop poaching and how to support efforts of people who really do have the solutions.
Hey, listen, Colleen, we're out of time. I really want to thank you. This is really informative, really, really almost inspirational too, you know, I'll say that too. So if you just let people know, where can they go to get the book? Where can they go to see, where can people go to get more information?
Well, thank you for having me. And they can order the book at radiusbooks.org. That's radiusbooks.org. And also my website has a link to that, which is colleenplum.com, colleenplum.com. My videos, the video is on my website, as well as the link to the book that I hope people will order, because they just so want people to read to see my pictures, but and it's a beautiful book they made. But to read all of these messages that are in there, it's, to me, it can sit on people's coffee table and then they can share it with people. You know, it can carry forward this message. So thank you much for having me.
All right. Thank you very much. And we'll stay in touch.
Great. Thanks.
Yeah, that was a terrific conversation. I really enjoyed it. And just when we finished up, we probably kept talking for another hour. So wonderful conversation. And by the way, I'm going to be posting those links from that Colleen mentioned of the videos. And you got to see these videos. They're really something else. They'll be up on my website. Just go over to the links section as well. And you'll be able to get them as well. All right. Listen, when we come back, we're going to go from the pachyderms to the asses. Or as they said in Pulp Fiction, we're going to go medieval on your ass. We'll be right back.
If we continue to consume our natural resources at the rate we do now, by 2050, it could take 3 Earths to meet our needs. Earth can't speak out, but we can. Be the voice for those who have no voice. Visit worldwildlife.org.
That's the very fitting Wild Asses from Camille Saint-Saëns' Carnival of the Animals. I could play that. Isn't it fun to say ass? I just have to say, it's fun to say ass. Yeah, I can do it legally. Anyway, if you like that, there's a lot more where that came from. So now, here's my conversation with Catherine Smithies on the medieval ass. Catherine L. Smithies is a medieval historian and research and teaching associate in the School of Historical and Philosophical Studies at the University of Melbourne. She is the author of a released book, Introducing the Medieval Ass, which is what we're going to talk about today. Catherine, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Well, I have to ask just before we get started. So this is an interesting angle on really any animal subject is that you are a medieval historian, but you're actually focusing on a particular animal in a particular time period. And this book is part of a series of medieval topics. And I was wondering if you could talk about it in general. Is it a whole bunch of animals within the series, or just a bunch of topics within a medieval time frame? And kind of where does your book fit into that?
Sure. So there's actually three streams in the series. And the first stream is short scholarly books about a specific topic. But my book sits in the middle stream, which is, again, short books using individual animals in the medieval world. So the first book was introducing the dragon, the second book introducing the medieval ass, and I think the next book is going to be introducing the medieval swan. So, they're short, focused books on specific animals.
So, all right. So we have a language thing we have to kind of get through here. And one of the things, as I was reading the book, there is just an inevitable, and this could be a North American, an American, I don't want to say Western thing, but the word ass has baggage to it. It has overhead. So when you have each of your, the scholar, the scholastic ass, the sexual ass, the religious ass, you know, each time it sounds like there's a little jab, there's a double entendre, but they're really, that may not necessarily be that, that may not be, I mean, you explain that it's clearly that you're going to stick to that word ass. It is what it is. And I was wondering if you could talk, about the language and sort of why we have this thing with the word ass, but then particularly how an ass might be different from, say, the term mule or donkey. And I think that you have in the book is something called an onager. Well, if you could just kind of help us out with all that.
Sure, yes. So, of course, in our modern world, in the Western world, we tend to call the ass the donkey. But in the medieval world, people knew the beast as the ass. So because it's a book about medieval donkeys, I wanted to be true to what medieval people would have thought. But of course, I know that in America, ass, donkey, it means your rear end, your bottom, right. Whatever. Right. And in English, it's got an R in it. It's ass, you know. So yes, you're quite right in that it's a play on words, but it's also contextually correct for the medieval period. An onager was a wild ass. As I explained in the book, it's from the Greek on, meaning ass, and agrios, meaning wild. So, you know, medieval people would have known of the onager,
even
if they hadn't met an onager as such.
Got it.
And of course, the mule is a cross between a male, I wrote this down just so that I didn't forget, it's a cross between a male donkey and a female horse.
Yeah, could you explain it? Because I you mentioned it in the book, and I was trying to understand it. That's the only common donkey and a female horse, never the other way around, not a male horse or female donkey. It would never be that, right?
It happens the other way.
Okay.
But the resulting animal is not known as a mule. It's and I've completely forgotten what it's called.
Oh, okay.
I want a Jenny, but it's not a Jenny.
Something weird. All right. So for Robert, it's a male donkey horse, and the mule is always sterile. In other words, two mules can't. Is it the mule? But there might be a male mule and a female mule. That
yes.
Could happen. But the male mule and the female mule will never mate.
No, very, very, very rarely.
Why? Do you know? Do we know?
So we're getting technical here. It's to do with the chromosomes. I think, I don't know which way around it is, but the donkey and the horse have 64 or 62 chromosomes. And when they mate, they make a beast that has 63 chromosomes. So the mule has 63. And for some reason, it renders it sterile.
I see. I mean, they could mate. They just wouldn't. Nothing would happen. No,
yes.
They wouldn't produce offspring. Oh, okay. I thought there was some sort of strange thing. They were repulsed by each other. So they wouldn't go near each other. It's just a genetic issue. Okay. All right. Yeah. Let's get into it. So the ass, I'm going to stay with that word, and I'm going to do it with a straight face for the rest of our time here. It is an animal of, and this is a constant theme in your book, just absolute paradoxes. You know, the way it has come to us as humans, so many different qualities that are completely, that would seem to be in common with each other, right? I mean, we have, it's stubborn, but it's steadfast. It's sacred, but it's profane. It's intelligent, but it's stubborn. And I know that's really broad and open, but I was wondering if you could just kind of get us started with that. Like that's the intrigue with this animal and our interest in it, yes?
Yes. So it was, as I was researching all the material I'm going to use in the book, it was the theme that stood out the most. Mm-hmm. That, you know, a medieval writer could talk about this ass being such a stubborn beast, but it was so sort of stupid that it allowed itself to be subjugated as soon as man wanted it to, you know, to take control of it. And then, of course, you get the association with Christianity. You know, Christ chooses to ride an ass into Jerusalem on Palm Sunday. You know, he's very deliberate. All the verses in the Bible that relate to that story tell the same story. You know, he wants to ride an ass. And of course, that goes back even further into sort of our prehistory, where kings did ride asses because there weren't any to ride. So it set them apart from their people, if you like.
But in the example of Christ riding the ass, that was to convey humility, that he would, that right, there was humble, versus the kings who were trying to convey the opposite, that the ass was in fact an elevated creature, and that you had to be wealthy in order to have one.
Yes, okay. Definitely. So, and again, it's another parasite.
Now, so there's a couple ways we can go here. So the whole concept of the ass in Christendom, there seems to be a real common sort of an overarching emphasis here, in that it is used as in that period, in the medieval period, where Christianity was really trying to break away from Judaism, from its Judaic roots. And so the symbol of the ass very much gets thrust onto Jews, as they are stubborn and too blind, I guess, or too dumb to see the way, the way of Christendom, right? Did I get that right? Is that
yes,
keeps?
Yeah, that's basically the story. Yes.
And it wends its way through. There's lots of references to that throughout. Priests are preaching this. It's in stories, right? And then what caught me in that theme is there is the only Old Testament ass is the story of Balaam's ass, and that is the only animal in the Old Testament, I believe, in the entire Bible, that speaks. Is that correct?
Apart from the serpent.
Oh, the serpent in the Garden of Eden, right? And there's another paradox, because the serpent in the Garden of Eden is quite evil, or treacherous, whereas the ass is almost enlightened. He sees the angel, whereas, and I'm, hope I pronounced Balaam correctly. And tell us about that. How that plays out. How Balaam's ass kind of plays out in the.
Balaam's ass is the all-seeing, all-knowing. He's the representative of the good or the faithful follower of God, and so he prevents Balaam from doing the wrong thing and going against God's word. And when Balaam goes to punish the beast, at that point, God reveals himself in the form of an angel, and Balaam realizes his mistake. Mm-hmm. Of course, it sits in the Old Testament, so it's more about, the old faith rather than the new faith from a medieval Christian perspective. Mm-hmm. But early Christian writers really had a bit of problem reconciling that.
Right.
How could there be a good sort of Old Testament ass when we want the ass to be good in the New Testament sort of thing? So they put the spin in it in a way, and sort of, they see it as a prophecy.
Why do you think from the biblical perspective, here's a theological challenge, that it was an ass? was in Balaam's time, would that have been the only beast of burden that he could, the only thing that he could have ridden, or could theologically another animal have been chosen? And is there meaning that it happened to have really been an ass?
I think, obviously I don't know exactly what time frame we're talking about when the Balaam story, exists, but my gut feeling is there would only have been asses to ride.
Oh, okay.
They would have been the only animals that would have been ridden at that mm-hmm. time. So it was never going to be anything else but an ass.
Okay. All right. Here's another thing that comes up a lot, and this one actually really intrigued me. You already kind of started mentioning it, that there is another paradox of the ass that is being easily subjugated. He's easily, and because he's so easily made docile or made to be subservient, that's kind of looked on like he's an ass, right? There you go. It's a negative trait. Yet it's juxtaposed with him being stubborn and being determined. And in fact, that makes him a difficult and not such a sought after creature. And that seems to be the real paradox that seems to play out. I think, going back to the religious theme, and tell me what you think of this, is that to be subjugated, that the clergy and the religious authorities during the medieval period really needed an example of subjugation to be good, because that is from where the clergy yielded its power. Is that a cuckoo theory, or what do you think of that?
No, it is a good theory. I mean, the whole idea of being a good Christian is that you are a servant of God, that you give yourself over to his will in a way. And I think, that's, so in a way, the donkey is the best exemplar of that, because as much as it might be a stubborn beast, it's the bearer of salvation. It carries Christ, and it willingly does this. It's this, the story in the Bible is a beast that's never been ridden before. So it immediately gives itself over to Christ to ride into Jerusalem.
Okay.
And a good Christian would do the same. A good Christian would, live the way that Christ says you're meant to live your life.
Without asking questions, without just be a good subservient ass, right? But that definition of being a good Christian, as defined by somebody who has serves to benefit from you being a good subservient ass, right? To me, that's the part that's rolling around in the back of my head. Somebody's making out, with this, right? Okay, there's another really cool recurring theme here, and this is not necessarily specific to the ass, but it seems to be really why the ass makes such a good paradigm, such a good example for this. And that's, here's a little quote, that the animal nature of human beings, this is how you say it, the resulting exposition reveals how the ass's very traits, asinine, irrational, lustful, were projected on human nature and became tropes and exemplars for human stereotypes and culturally coded behaviors. I think this was in the chapter about the, I think this was the scholastic ass. Do you think that the ass is unique from that perspective? In other words, are there other animals that could be chosen, or is there something really unique and special about the ass?
Good question. And I haven't thought about it. So you put me on the spot there.
I mean, it does. It seems to have... Right. The book seems to suggest that it is, that there's such a, it's so much conflict, or I don't keep using the word paradox, but I can't think of another animal where we have that kind of that kind of mixed metaphor, whatever, where we have that kind of a relationship where we have both.
No, I think it is interesting, and as like you, I'm not sure I can come up with another animal. I mean, today we do refer to, I might say derogatory, oh, she's a cow, or he's a dog. But do I really mean that person embodies the the qualities of that animal? No, I don't think so. Not in the way that I think the ass transcends that boundary.
Well, actually, there is dog. Dog is one that actually has a similar, but not to the degree of ass. You will hear people say things like, treat you like a dog, you know, worse than a dog, you know, and yet a dog is revered, you know, almost revered. There's no other animal that has a special relationship with humans as the dog does. And yet it kind of has that double thing. But I don't think anywhere near to the degree that the ass does, you know. I thought that, and it actually was kind of, as you got sort of towards the end there, we really saw that we got out of the medieval time, and we actually, I thought it was a really clever comparison to see those two things in modern animation. So we have Shrek is a donkey. He's not an ass. His name is Donkey, right? And he has he's a wise, kind of sort of a smart mouth kind of guy, but he's persistent. He kind of has those qualities. It's not an accident that they cast a donkey in that role. Versus Eeyore, who's Winnie the Pooh's kind of doleful, sad, you know, or nothing. And I don't know, I just wondered if you had any thoughts on how that got into, how it worked its way into the, out of the medieval time into the modern time.
I'm not exactly sure how it worked its way out, but I mean, my gut feeling is there's such strong tropes and ideas that of course they've persisted. I think one of the criticisms you could make of that chapter is that I jump from the medieval with only a few examples in the middle before I get to the modern time. But, you know, word counts are word counts. And I'm sure that this idea of the ass being either pessimistic or, you know, the negative pessimistic traits that Eeyore exhibits are there in those middle centuries, if you like.
All right, I have one last question that I would be remiss without, you know, I have to ask, because we are here in the United States, we are hot and heavy in the political season. So, and you did wait to the very end. I thought, this is great, because is she going to do it? And at the very end, we got into why the Democratic Party uses the donkey as its symbol. So please enlighten our listeners, tell us the story of how this came to be.
Okay, let's hope I can do this justice for your American listeners.
So, careful.
So let me think now. It was Andrew Johnston, who was a Democratic candidate, and one of his opponents labelled him, I think, a jackass, as being stubborn. So, you know, he embodied all those negative traits. And Andrew Jackson thought, actually, I can use this to my advantage. So rather than go for the negative traits, he went for the positive traits of being steadfast. So, you know, if you vote for me, you vote for somebody who's reliable, who's steadfast and true, and so on. And basically, that's the origins of how the Democrats came to adopt the donkey. There was a cartoonist called Nast, who did a cartoon a little bit after the original Andrew Jackson story. And I think it was that maybe cemented the idea of the Democratic donkey.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it's the same cartoon, but the symbol now it's on our ballots. It's the donkey kicking with his, I think it's almost the same picture you use in each of the chapters, with kicking with the hind legs up, which is, I guess, to convey, I'm not going to take it. You know, this is, you know, I am very, you're not going to push me around. Sometimes I wish it was true. All right, cool. Hey, listen, we're out of time. Really, thank you so much for that. This was a lot of fun. If you just tell listeners where they can, what the title of the book is and where they can get it and anything else you'd like to.
So my book is called Introducing the Medieval Ass. And for America, it's going to be published in November by the University of Chicago Press. And if you go to their website, you can follow all the links if you want to buy it. And I think it's very reasonably priced at about $16, American dollars.
Absolutely, very reasonably priced. And I recommend it highly. It was a lot of fun. Like, and we were talking before, a very easy read. All right, that's
Catherine Smithies,
University of Melbourne. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Laurent.
All right, that was a lot of fun. Okay, so when we return, Dr. Tom Picard is going to take a look at the most common cat illnesses and what to do about them. Don't go away.
Your pets don't like getting in cages and cars to go to the vet any more than you like sitting in a waiting room. Why not remove the stress for both of you? Have All Pets House Calls with me, Dr. Tom Picard, come take care of your pets from the comfort of their own couch. We do checkups and exams for illnesses, problems, shots, and much more. Monday through Saturday appointments throughout far and wide areas of Philadelphia and surrounding suburbs. Please call us at 215-843-1780, or please feel free to submit questions so I can answer them on the air for you. Contact us by email at allpetshousecalls@comcast.net or visit our website at allpetshousecallsvet.com.
We think our vet is very helpful. We think our vet is smart and nice. Our vet takes such good care of us, but would rather stay home. We'd rather be home to catch mice.
We're back now on The Other Animals here on WWDB, joined now by Dr. Tom Picard of All Pets House Calls. Hey, Tom.
You know, it's happy funny. Fall, everyone.
Your music is, that's an elephant theme, isn't it? I always feel like I have to, that fit in today. Isn't that,
yeah,
isn't that where you got that? Right. Okay. All right. So what do you got for us today? So common illnesses for, let's starting with cats. This seems like it could be a very broad topic, but it's common. So tell us, what do we got and what should owners do?
Very, very much so a broad subject. We did touch on these in the past couple of weeks too, urinary tract infections, and then last week, skin allergies and things we talked about. So those are also some of the most common problems. One we didn't touch on, and there's others too we'll probably not be able to get to, but when your cat is sneezing, there's a lot of things that people think are going on. Yeah. This time of year, like we were talking about last week, allergies are a big deal for people as well as animals. But animals don't really sneeze due to allergies, unlike people.
Really?
What they do, they get with allergies, they get itchiness of their skin. People get itchy eyes, itchy nose, throat, and sneeze, therefore. So people really associate, you know, the sneezing more with it. But when your cat is sneezing excessively, and dogs can have this happen too, but significantly more rare, just surprisingly. Cats, even indoor ones, get colds. And they turn into upper respiratory infections, which, you know, it's a combination of a virus and bacteria taking advantage of the situation. Uh-huh. So if your cat's going to sneeze normally sometimes, it's not to be alarmed.
There's something, it's funny you say that, there's something a little scary about, and I have this one cat that will have sneezing jags, almost like a human, and, you know, she'll sneeze and keep sneezing, and then you kind of, your mind wanders a little bit. That is it just a nasal thing, or you start worrying about is it lungs? You know, is there something further down that's causing it? And it's hard to tell because they don't have that type of raspy sneeze that humans have. They just kind of, it's just little nasal sneeze. I don't know.
Yeah, certainly they can get sneezing from irritants in the home, which is very typical, especially if you are a cat or a dog. You go around sniffing things all the time. You're inhaling dust particles and other sorts of things with cats, probably the dust from their litter box. But just going around everywhere sniffing stuff, you're going to inhale stuff up your nose that's going to be irritating, and you might sneeze, you know, once or 20 times or whatever. But the difference is and this is a common thing to know, when is my cat sick? When do they need attention for this? Generally speaking, what we tell people to watch for is excessively runny eyes and nose, just more than the normal. And particularly if you start to see yellowish or greenish color to it, or whitish, anything that's clear, or even brownish, which is just kind of a normal tear staining, That can just be normal. There can indicate a problem too, but generally when we need to see them to get them checked out and probably put them on antibiotics to fight the bacteria part is when you see yellow, greenish, whitish discharge from eyes or nose, and they're just sneezing day after day after day. And it's like, you know, a couple of days of this and you definitely probably better get them seen.
So the color, that discharge that you're describing, brownish, that's an indication of a something going on bacterial, right? In other words,
and often the reason is it starts out with a virus, and well over 80-some% of domestic cats in this country have chronic herpes virus that just manifests itself never or sometimes with colds like this under stress or some sort of other condition. Coronaviruses, Khaleesi virus, a bunch of viruses that they get that cause upper respiratory things, and then will go away sometimes on their own. But when they don't go away, you start seeing yellow and green, snotty stuff coming out of their eyes and nose. That's when we need to see them and help them, because cats have a hard time breathing normally through their nose sometimes. They have very narrow passages. They're not really good at mouth breathing and panting like a dog. If you see a cat breathing through its mouth, definitely get them seen. It's definitely usually the signs of a problem. Cats are not mouth breathers typically.
It's funny. I don't want to presage what I think you're going to do next week, but I tend to think of breathing issues kind of with dogs. I know certain breeds where they actually breed, like the pugs or something, where they kind of smash the noses. It is really weird, and I know they have all kinds of nasal issues as a result of that. Is there ever, it's the same kind of thing for the cat though. Will the sneeze or the cough sound different if it's a lung issue than it is if it's just a pure nasal issue?
Yes, I mean, most of the cat ones tend to be upper respiratory, what we think of as more in the head, nose, sinuses, and you know, maybe a little bit down into their trachea is irritated. Lower respiratory refers to a problem down in their lungs, and that can happen, and that can generally be what will happen when they have an upper respiratory infection that doesn't get taken care of, and it can proceed to become more of a lung problem. But for most cases, cats, it tends to stay upper. If you start to hear more of a rattling, really difficulty breathing, their chest is going in and out, their stomach's going up and down, they're really struggling to kind of get a breath, that can be indications of something more lower down in the tract, or just a really bad upper respiratory too.
All right, good to know. Tom, hey, listen, thanks. We're out of time. So, thanks, everyone. I want to thank my guests, Colleen Plum and Catherine Smithies. And thanks to my very capable engineer, Dan Frentz, stepping in today. As always, we'd love to hear from you with your comments, ideas, or suggestions. Or if there are topics you'd like Dr. Picard to address, just check out theotheranimals.com and let us know. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at The Other Animals, and same with Facebook. Until then, find a belly to rub.